here.
Yeah. So I'd like to present, can everybody hear me in the back? Up more? Is that better? I'd like to present a new way of thinking about how we can monitor a system, which is glaciated mountain headwaters, which I know you all are aware of, living where we do, that's not particularly well studied in terms of the physical parameters that go into monitoring protocols or go into doing monitoring in systems. And I'm going to be talking about my research that I did for my PhD mostly in Mount Rainier National Park, which is obviously a really interesting system. But instead of focusing on the glaciated part, the actively glaciated part of Mount Rainier, which is most studied, I was looking at the relic area. And we'll discuss more what relic is all about as we proceed on this talk. So one of the big questions is why the sudden interest in doing monitoring in these kinds of systems. One of the big reasons is that these glacier systems are wasting at a fairly rapid rate. In North Cascades, they're losing 20 to 40% of their volume in a very, very short period of time. And that's a really significant factor. And what that means is many, many stream basins are evolving from an active glacial-dominated hydrology to a relic system. And so it's kind of important to understand where we're heading in terms of these systems. We don't know what the consequences might be. And these are good examples from 1960 to 2005. That's a pretty obvious change in state, and also another example. And the website that's listed in the bottom of this slide has quite a bit of information on this mass wasting process that's from the North Cascades National Park. So in terms of how I'll go through this talk, first, I'm going to talk about some background, kind of get us up to speed on these systems, both in terms of the science and a little bit about the management. Then we'll look at the research, which I did in Mount Rainier, both the methods and the results, and then really bring that together and hopefully synthesize it with a conceptual framework for monitoring that might help what you have to do in a system like this that is very, very complex. The first big difference that, if nothing else makes sense in this talk, I really want to stress is that glacial basins and lowland basins are significantly different, particularly in the way in which sediment and water is transported through these systems. This is at North Cascades National Park, Fisher Basin, and all your material that's being transported is in vertical layering, as opposed to what many of us are most used to thinking of in terms of geomorphology with the horizontal types of sediment transport and movement. The other big, big difference is that the scale of the disturbance processes in a place like Mount Rainier are considerably larger in relation to the size of the stream channel. If you think of a floodplain river, something like the lower Snoqualmie, you're thinking of something that the river and its floodplain is quite large in comparison to the surrounding valley. And in these systems, often these streams are really overcome, or underfit is the term, by their surroundings. So this little diagram shows kind of the axes that emphasize these big differences. We have the topography of these systems tends to be very steep versus gentle, and the blue circle represents the domain of many lowland river floodplains. The geology is often more complex in these mountain systems as opposed to a very uniform geology, and climate can be very variable, lots of microclimates. As opposed to glaciated mountain headwaters, steep, variable, and complex. This is a conceptual model of kind of the main point that sort of underpins what we're talking about with these systems. The geomorphology, which you just saw, can often be very complex, the geology. Shows a continuum from an end member of incremental change, very stable systems, to very large-scale disturbance processes, and then every scale in between. And what's really important is that the geomorphic response controls much of the hydrologic response. So your hydrology, which is crucial to your biota, is often driven by what the structure of the geomorphology in the basin shows. So the bottom line here, we can see very episodic disturbance versus a sustained condition. And all of these interact and are linked together in how these systems work. This is another schematic of another crucial series of end members that really affect these systems and drive the habitat, which then it provides the living conditions for aquatic biota. And as you may know, in monitoring, we're concerned about the species that live in these systems and how they're doing and how they're changing, what their assemblages are. So this refers to glacial forms of stream flow as opposed to groundwater-dominated stream flow and what's called quick flow, which is dilute meltwaters often coming on the surface of the basin. They're very distinct. They have very different chemistry. They operate differently in terms of their timing and their regimes and their response patterns. So the percentage of a particular type of flow that you have in a channel, where the water source is, where it comes from, really affects your biota. And so this looks at how you would position different, in this case, sampling sites. This is for 2 years of sampling in the Swiss Alps. And where they would fit in the quadrant of their source and their stream flow, and then what that would mean in terms of species change. So from a management perspective, we've been sort of talking about the science. We need to understand these geomorphic and hydrologic controls to effectively monitor these ecosystems, because they are the core condition for the habitat. Biological indices for monitoring are dependent on this ability to accurately define physical habitats. And point-based physical habitat metrics, most of what we have traditionally used in basins, they are very difficult to interpret without a good spatial context. So my null hypothesis was that if relic glaciated headwater mountain basins with similar basin scale parameters, sort of the typical parameters that we all look at, elevation, slope, have similar stream flow response. And traditionally, hydrology would have said they do. These were always thought of as surface flow systems with very rapid response. And as we've said before, these relic basins will replace many of the active glacial systems, likely in the next 50 years. So this is a map of the where I did my work. This is on the east side of Mount Rainier. And there are five basins. Four of them had gauging stations. The fifth one, Shaw Creek, was supposed to have a gauging station, but what is typical of these systems, we had a major debris flow in that basin in the spring, right before I was going to install it, and the creek was no longer flowing on the surface, but became a subsurface channel. And rather than take it out of the study, it seemed to me that the variability, the natural variability that's part of these systems, is something that we really should be looking at when assessing the basins. So it was kept in the study, even though it could not be gauged. And all of these basins were affected by Pleistocene glaciation to a very strong extent. And one of the key messages which I would like to talk about is how the glacial structure actually really controls a great deal of the hydrology in these systems. So the five basins I looked at are pretty similar. The only one, that's kind of an outlier is Crystal Basin. As you can see, it's a smaller basin. It has a steeper slope. But the mean change in basin elevation is similar to the others. And it actually had enough characteristics that were really crucial to what we're talking about, that its smaller size was really not a factor. The two basins that should have been most alike in many ways were Lost and Deer Creek. As you can see, their drainage area is similar, their slope is similar, and their elevation difference is also very similar. And we'll be seeing more of those two basins, because they didn't turn out to be quite what we expected. In terms of the methods for this study, what I was trying to do is combine geomorphic metrics with hydrologic indices. In ecosystem studies, more commonly, you might do a geomorphic focus, and many, many mountain ecologists focus on hydrology. But I was trying to find some way to put them together to see if their linkage was quite strong and if it might have predictive capability. So I'm going to start with the structure, which is called macroform structure of these glacial systems. This is Shaw Creek, the basin I mentioned that had the disturbance, the big debris flow right before it was supposed to be gauged. You can see how that might be occurring. It's an episodic, repeated type of disturbance, which actually extends all the way down to its confluence with the White River. But the really important thing to observe here is that there is a very distinct structure, which is repeated over and over and over in these basins. You have a cirque valley, cirque walls, some kind of very steep outlet, and then similar kinds of areas shown here. The slide on the left shows Lost Creek Basin, which is also on the north side of Mount Rainier. It's a very complicated system. It has a large area that is why it's called Lost Creek, because the channel does not daylight. And it also has a pretty significant area here where the outlet for Upper Palisades Lake is completely subsurface at this time, which does not mean that it always has been or will be, but right now it is. And this basin is a sort of typical example of glacial macroform structure that has a lot of hydrologic implications. For instance, over here, there's a rock glacier, quite large. It's a relic rock glacier. It's a large deposit. And there appears to be quite a bit of water movement within these systems that may have started in terms of pathways when it was still a glacier, but have now continued as it becomes relic. So this kind of also illustrates the connection between these scales. You have the basin scale, and then you start to break down to these specific zones that directly relate to glaciation. Now, to make some sense of that, we looked at the channel longitudinal profiles, and which is historically in geomorphology always been a good place to look, and started observing the differences between colluvial, alluvial, and bedrock areas within this channel profile. And we'll go over what those terms mean. So this would be a difference between what, I don't know if you've often seen, but the typical concave longitudinal profile that is common to lowland river basins. This is an idealized version. Obviously, there's more heterogeneity in actual many basins. But many are, you know, have on average this very simple structure. And the difference between that and what's found in many of these glaciated basins is the stepped longitudinal profile. And what that means is that there's a break and slope, a valley step, a valley step. And that has significant differences in terms of how water is stored, how water is moved, what kind of systems you create, and in turn, how this is going to affect biota. So this would be the classic flat meander channel type, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. And this up here, which comes from Dave Montgomery and Buffington's 1997 article on rescale channel types. It's a real channel. It's at the very top of the headwaters. First order kind of stream situation. And it's where a stream will begin. But it's often just a gravity system that's over dominated by the colluvium, the material that's around it. And these systems are a little different than what you might find in these kinds of basins. So here are some slides of the source colluvial valley segment. And I want to point out that I'm using the term valley segment, not reach. In these upland systems, the concept of stream reach doesn't work as well. It doesn't have the same basis. And the source colluvium is often where you find where water begins. It's the channel initiation point. There are often springs of every imaginable scale and size. And also characteristic is a very shallow meltwater channel that much of it is a losing stream or gaining and then losing within a large colluvial matrix, so a lot of sediment and not much transport capacity. So looking at this structure that we just saw, for instance, with the slide of Lost Creek, we have a cirque wall zone, which is often very basically bedrock. And then some kind of depositional zone is very common. A cirque valley, and as you know, that often includes lake or lakes, and then inlet and outlet streams that connect with those lakes. And the inlets and outlets do not have to all be surface. In fact, many of them are mixed surface and subsurface systems. Some are perennial, some are ephemeral. And then in this case, then you have the subsurface channel draining the lake at the interface between the colluvium and probably bedrock. There's also a condition called the sink colluvial valley, which is a losing stream, often in a debris cone, where you have a very large sediment supply, very coarse, over long periods, with potentially an alluvial channel running on top of the valley segment of colluvium. So again, that word underfed, it's a very, very small stream in a very, very large valley or landscape. And this actually comes from Shaw Creek. In this time that I've been doing my dissertation, the channel is now has now surfaced. It surfaces as an ephemeral channel. So it only runs during snow melt. So you're starting to see reach scale alluvial or fluvial processes going on with this channel that's starting to create a bed. But the real action is in this colluvial cone, which is, again, I can't stress enough, very large scale, and often includes, in this case does, a buried channel, which if you stand out here, out there in August, when the surface channel is no longer running, you can hear the sediment transport in the subsurface channel. So it's really cool. And obviously there's a lot of transport work being performed underground. So to recap what I've been talking about, these different types, we have the rill, which was the funny little channel that's coming out of the extreme top of the headwaters, versus these valley segment scale types of channels, the source channel, including springs, and the sink, which we just looked at. And the crucial message is that the sediment supply in these systems far overwhelms the transport capacity, which is why they are not fluvial systems, as opposed to bedrock channels where the transport capacity has scoured the bed. So there's very little sediment in those terrains. So we saw a slide that showed the upper source colluvial channel surrounded and embedded within the colluvium, and a sink channel. And this gives you an idea of how this fits along this stepped longitudinal profile that I mentioned that has distinct zones, the lower part of the cirque wall, some kind of hanging valley, a colluvial section, and then this big depositional zone with the sink. This is Shaw Creek again, which you've seen pictures of. As opposed to alluvial channel reach types, which we're also very familiar with, something like a cascade alluvial channel flowing within a bedrock matrix, sandbed alluvial channels that act exactly like sandbed channels anyway, anywhere, but the point being that it's on a lake bed, a former lake bed, but it's part of this larger colluvial framework. So you will see a lot of these reaches that are distinct. And then the classic bedrock channel flowing through a canyon, which I know everyone's familiar with. So looking at the hydrology of these basins, these five basins in Mount Rainier, one thing that I found, which was pretty surprising, was that even though the basic valley structure was very similar in all of these basins, just like the basin metrics and parameters were, many of these systems did not really have the kinds of colluvial debris-caused or glacier-caused areas that were found in others. And this had a huge difference in the resulting hydrology. So we're going to deal now with the hydrologic indices. We've been looking at the geomorphic metrics. And probably the most important one for a study like this is something called recession constants. This is what's a stream hydrograph, and it's looking at stream flow and temperature between Deer Creek and Lost Creek, which I think you remember really should be very, very similar. This is the recession limb for the actual discharge, which is this line for Deer Creek, and this line, the black, varying for Lost Creek. One is slow recession, very stable system. The other, as you can see, is what's called very flashy. And the temperature, even though it's going in the opposite direction, reflects this. So from snowmelt, the end of snowmelt, which is in the beginning of June, to the beginning of the what's called base flow period, which is the low flow, the temperature in Deer Creek has gone up quite a bit when compared to Lost Creek, which again is very stable comparatively. And that's a pretty normal relationship when you have stable temperature and a very slow response recession in these usually associated with groundwater systems or subsurface flow systems, as opposed to a more typical flashy kind of basin. So recession constants is just a very simple measurement to compare the receding, the falling limb of the hydrograph. And it's done by picking a point where it's assumed, and there's many ways to do it, but this is one. Picking a point where it's assumed that the surface flow is starting to decline, and over a period of time, you're now looking at what kind of subsurface or groundwater inputs you might be having in the channel. This is the cord to a stream gauge. This is Lost Creek that was positioned in the central fallway of the channel and provided the numbers, the time series, which we could then use to generate recession constants. And the results from this is a median, a graph of all data taken over a 3-year period from these systems, and these are continuous time series, and then looking just at the falling limb of particular hydrograph events for each channel. And as you can see from this, Crystal and Loss have very high recession numbers, which means slow response, very stable, very slow flow. Crystal Creek, even during the 2006 flood at Mount Rainier, which I don't know if any of you saw that park right after that flood, but it was an amazing place. And I managed to sneak in the day after that flood into Crystal Creek just to see what was going on. And it just did not have anywhere near the flow that everywhere else in, you know, especially the White River, which was flooding over the road, showed. As opposed to Deer and Laughing Water Creek, which are much lower, and show much less base flow. To compare the hydrologic indices with the geomorphic metrics, I then compared the amount of colluvial channel in the basin with the recession, median recession constants for these systems to see what kind of relationship having that kind of colluvium in a system would do for predicting what kind of flow response you would have. And as you can see, it was a pretty happy comparison for research. The next metric that I looked at, or indice, was stable isotope analysis. And I'm not going to go into the particulars of stable isotopes. I was looking at oxygen 18, and why it's called a stable isotope is because it's integral to the actual water molecule. So it's a very stable, unchanging metric, although phase changes do alter the ratio of having very light versus heavy isotopes in a system. So it does tell you a lot about where the water came from or what kind of storage, kind of average storage, is integrated in a system. And the results from this also showed this difference, minus 15 is extremely light, suggests that this basin was storing a lot of winter precipitation in a slow release system, as opposed to Deer and Laughing Water Creek, which throughout the period of record, which was snowmelt through storm flow, I was not in these basins during the winter, so I don't have any isotope data from that period. But they reflected whatever the changes were occurring in the precipitation. So they really showed an integrated meteoric marker, as opposed to crystal and, to a lesser extent, lost, which reflected what kind of storage and mixing is going on in upper, in the case of crystal, or middle large storage areas in the basin. So doing the same combination of metrics with indices, I looked at the colluvial channel area in the upper basin. And the reason for doing the upper basin is particularly crystal is dominated by the upper Cirque and Hanging Valley sections. The lower part is very, very small. And so the actual stream miles, or stream meters, comparing, for instance, crystal and Deer, that rate, those, that number of stream miles was actually very, very similar. So you would assume, particularly with stable isotopes, because isotopes are dependent on temperature and elevation, among other things, that Deer and crystal should be very much alike. The fact that they not only fell out in a way similar to the recession constants you just saw, and also indicated these very distinct differences, really does suggest that these slow response colluvial basins, valley segments, are very important. So to wrap up, this research really showed that it is possible to use the channel long profile as a way to some extent, predict stream flow response within these characteristic glacial structures. And it's very useful to look and identify comparable physical habitats, and especially that the colluvial valley segments control slow response stream flow regimes. So for monitoring, this would suggest that the analysis of the channel long profile should aid in the spatial context, and that context could then give you much more foundation with which to interpolate physical ecological metrics, things like species assemblage. The stream flow regime is created by this hierarchy of morphologies. So as you look at the different scales, they really affect each other and control the stream flow. And as a continuation of that, it's important to think of stratifying your landscape that you're interested in monitoring, so you're really choosing comparable sampling sites. Because that is one of the real tricks with monitoring. If you have great statistics, but but your actual replicates aren't really replicates, then it's kind of destroys your project. So this is the framework that was advertised from the beginning. And I'll just go through it very quickly. It's important to account for these regional metrics, climate, glaciation, what kind of glaciation occurred. The Cordillera ice sheet found in North Cascades has a very definite signature that varies from the smaller alpine headwater basins and does affect what your hydrology will be. And you're not going to have much of a glacial signature over long periods of time if your bedrock is very soft, because it's just going to turn into a fluvial system. So within these sort of general constraints, if we're looking at relic basins versus active, because active basins have very different physiochemical and hydrologic regimes, we can then look at the macroform structure. In this case, I'm highlighting the valley step, which we've been looking at with some of those photos with Shaw Creek. And with that, within that, the colluvial basin with a sink system, meaning that you're losing, not gaining. And it's an important area. And this, again, is the sink area within the longitudinal profile. Pretty characteristic, sometimes called a debris apron, sometimes a debris cone. Has many characteristics with alluvial fans, but not necessarily, they weren't necessarily the same thing. So the implications for monitoring is that the measurement of physical characteristics at very fine scales, everybody looks at dissolved oxygen and temperature at a point and many other metrics. They're really important, but if you don't have a context with which to understand them or enough of a spatial coverage to really know what they mean, they can be misleading. The stratification of the sampling unit should reflect structural differences and the disturbance processes that are then acting upon the glacial structure. The other big implication of this is that not all monitoring locations or habitat types in such a complex system are as appropriate for use in aquatic monitoring as others. And just like in lowland or other systems, we really want large accumulation zones and more stable conditions to monitor so you can actually let the biota do what they do. In this case, many of these colluvial systems where they're being added to, the accumulation zones over time, they may be experiencing disturbance processes on the surface, but the interstitial spaces, the places where many biota like to live and hide the refuges, could be very stable even if the surface is changing quite a bit. So I want to thank you very much. And does anybody have questions?
So, any questions?
Okay, I'll ask one. So.
Okay.
So, what difference has it made to stream flow and to the loss of glaciers around here? Lowland stream flow, does it make any difference? Do you lose the glaciers?
Well, I mean, did you hear the question? Is the loss of the glaciers going to really affect stream flow? And I think that that's actually more nuanced of a situation than it's often portrayed. What I've seen in these systems is there is a lot of storage, water storage, that both precipitation and snow are going to recharge. That doesn't mean that it's at all good to me that we're losing glaciers, but I don't think it means that there's going to be this sudden lack of any water recharge going on. I think that's much too simple.
But in the Himalayas, there's the story that a lot of that loss of glacier has a big effect on in India, for example, right?
And even the Sierra, you know, the Sierras in California, they're much more of a bedrock system, you know. Well, they don't have glaciers, but they would be an example of a system that would have a lot more effect. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Could you educate me a little bit on isotope analysis and what it is?
Repeat the question.
Yes. The question is, could I go through isotope analysis? And I think that's actually something I should talk to you about. It's a very complicated, it's definitely a half-hour question. But thank you.
Basically, you could say that oxygen 16 is a normal one, and 18 is the hit.
The rare, very rare. It's like 99% versus 1%. Yeah. And so being able to isolate 18 really gives you a sense of where the water came from, starting with your atmospheric, from your precipitation. So it's a global, I mean, it's a cool marker, but it's a very tricky one.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.